My name is John, and I am an alcoholic. And my home group is the Belleville Thursday Night Group over in Belleville, New Jersey. My sobriety date is February 20th, 1993. I want to thank the group for asking me to come up here tonight and speak. For me, it's always an honor to be able to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I know from my own experience that this was going on well before I ever got here. The first meeting I was at was an open speakers meeting. Similar to this, the only thing they did was they turned off the lights and like it was a spotlight on the speakers. But I'll talk about that meeting in a little bit. Like I said, my sobriety date is February 20th, 1993. I grew up in a family where I have my three sisters, my mother, my father, very middle class upbringing. Had pretty much everything that I ever needed. They provided, they did what they needed, and it was awesome. The problem was that for me, I just never knew where I belonged because I was the second oldest, so I had an older sister and two younger sisters. I know when my younger sisters were born, as my parents tell me, I kept hoping that one of them would be a brother because I always wanted a brother. Don't know why. I think maybe to just abuse or whatever, you know, like a big brother would do, and that didn't happen, and this was the family that I was brought up in. And they provided for me, and they did everything they could. I look back on that as a true blessing these days. But I was drunk. I was just waiting for that alcohol to be placed in me. And I don't know when my first drink happened. 10, 11, 12, something like that. It was probably at one of the family parties because we always had parties, like during the summer, because we were one of the, I think on my dad's side, we're the only ones that had a house. Everybody else lived in the city, so they all had apartments. So we had a backyard, and everybody could come over. And it was always shown as a good time. And probably me and my male cousins ran and grabbed the little nips that they had, and we would do like a quick little dash to see how many we could grab, get away from the parents, and like get back up to my room and without getting caught and all that stuff. And that's probably when I really had my first drink. I know shortly after that time period, I was starting to just grab alcohol from my parents, drinking with the neighborhood kids, and around 12, 13, something like that is when I had my first real blackout. And that was because I took a bottle of Canadian Scotch whiskey from my parents. I was hanging out with the kids. I was down at the local park. And they said, John, you can't drink that whole bottle. I went, yes, I can. And we kept going back and forth for a few minutes. So I cracked the top on it, downed the whole bottle, and 20-plus years later, I still have no idea what happened that night. People had told me little events, and I don't know. But what that really meant was that for the next 12 years, my drinking was basically going to be the same way. When I first started drinking, really drinking, it was let me drink as much as I can, as fast as I can, and whatever happened, happened. Well, that's what was going to happen for the next 12 years. The big things that happened were it went from the local neighborhood park to the backyards and gatherings like that to being in the bars. You know, I went from riding my bicycle and crashing on those bicycles to driving cars and crashing cars. I never saw alcohol as a problem. Alcohol wasn't a problem I had. And I just continued to live the way I thought I wanted to. I went through high school. I thought a five-year plan was better than a four-year plan. Wasn't really what I wanted to do, but it sort of happened that way because alcohol was more important. I was a good student. I played sports. I wasn't a stellar athlete, but I was always on the teams. I loved it, but then I learned more about alcohol. As my drinking progressed, the things that I thought were important early on, which was school, my family, sports, each one of them started drifting away because alcohol was more important. And why? Because it allowed me to not feel. You know, alcohol allowed me to be whoever I wanted to be. If I needed to be a big shot at some point and show off in somehow, alcohol gave me that courage. If I was talking with the women, well, it gave me the courage to talk to them. If I needed to have a better intellectual debate, at least I thought so, it allowed me to do that. Alcohol allowed me to be whatever you all wanted me to be. And that's really what happened. See, during that time period, I also started having some physical ailments where I lost my hair. And I really felt like I was an outsider. And what alcohol did was allow me to be a part of. Because you know what? I could be whatever you wanted me to be. I would be your best friend. And it didn't matter what I had to do. And I lied, I stole, I cheated, I did whatever I had to continue my drinking. And during that span, being a teenager, it wasn't always easy to get alcohol. So I learned about a lot of the chemicals, and they were a part of my life for a while. Just because they were so much easier to get at times. But my true love was always alcohol. Because you know what? I heard about the rock and roll stars, and you know, like Jimi Hendrix, Jim Morrison, Janis Joplin, and that crew, and they were all drinkers. And I loved it because, you know, and the poets. Those are all the people I wanted to be like. And you know what? I could romanticize alcohol, and I could make it, yeah, you know what? This is good. So that's what I did. My life was about drinking. And it's easy to see that now. When I was drinking, I never saw it that way. I hung out with kids, and we hung out in people's driveways. We hung out in the garages. I remember cleaning out a friend's garage at the end of one summer. We had those industrial-sized garbage cans that are like the 60-gallon tubs or something like that. We had about 6 or 7 of those filled with empty bottles, beer bottles, everything else. These were all just in this garage. We were like, oh, man, too bad we couldn't get like a return on deposit on them. So we thought we could get some money for all this stuff, and we couldn't. Because we just wanted more booze. We just turned it right back into more booze. We all drank basically the same way, but none of them are here. I am. And the reason why I say that is not everybody I hung out with needs to be here. Not everybody that I drank with was an alcoholic. For myself, I am. For them, you know what? That's their own journey. If they are, most of my old friends know that I'm sober today. And if they need something, you know what? I'd be there for them. But they don't need to be here. That's great. My drinking career continued on. I tried college because I thought that was the right thing to do after high school, even with my stellar performance. And you know what? I couldn't do it. I would try to go to classes, and I needed a drink. I needed to work. I needed my money for my booze, and I'd be at the bar every day. And I was underage. See, the drinking age in Jersey then was 21. I was 18. I found places that would serve me. I found places and I found ways to get the booze that I needed. And I'll hang out with anybody, anywhere, and do anything. And I'm not proud of that today, but it's, once again, that's the journey I had to travel down. I did a geographical move, which I did not know at the time that it was a geographical move. A relationship I was in ended with the woman that I'd been seeing for about 5 years. I had gotten a ring, I was ready to propose, and she told me she couldn't deal with me anymore. The amount of alcohol and the amount of drugs I was doing, she couldn't live with me. And the reason why I say that is at that point in time, I had a moment of clarity. And I said, okay, all those drugs I was doing, well, you know what, that was the problem, wasn't the alcohol. So my great thought was, well, I could just go to the bar and drink more. And so that's what I started doing because I was 21. You know, and for me, I thought that made it okay. Because, you know what, going to the bar, that was social. I was going to be around people. I would have friends. I'd meet this new group of people. I'd meet the woman that I should really be with. And this is where my mindset was. At that time, the job I had, I lost. I had taken a position down outside of Philadelphia, and that's where I made my geographical move. Within 3 days, I knew how to find everything I needed. I found the bars where the easy women were at, where I could get the booze cheaper, and I could find anything else I needed. And I ran that way for another year. And I knew something was wrong. See, down there, I started doing a lot of things that I never thought I would really do. I was stealing from my company. I was stealing from the people that were employing me. I started not paying bills. I started not being able to pay my rent. And you know what? I didn't care. I didn't care because I needed to continue drinking the way I was. And through that process, I did move back up north. And the reason why I moved back up north was I said, you know what, this isn't working down here. I said, I really thought I missed my family. And I really thought that I wanted to try a new way of living. No, I just couldn't live by myself. I couldn't function in society. I couldn't function as a normal human being. And I learned that by doing inventory, and I learned that by looking back at this and seeing it for what it really was. I came back home at about the age of 22. I was living with my parents. I was able to find a job with my cousin who worked in a warehouse. I met him in a bar. And when he saw me in the bar, he said, John, what are you doing here? I was like, well, Phil, I've been down here looking at these warehouses trying to find some work. It's like, I moved back up here. I need to work. And I was like, you got any work for me? And he was like, no. He called me a month later, and he had a job for me. I stayed at that job for about 9 years. That job was a saving grace. My parents were a saving grace. And the reason why I say that is it allowed me a place to continue to somewhat function at. It gave me a sense of stability. My parents gave me a place to live. And it was sort of a safety net, which maybe was a blessing, maybe wasn't. All I know is that helped me. It helped me in a way because I felt that I always had a place to come back to. You know, I had some place to crash. And I don't know what would happen if I didn't have that. I try not to run down that road. I did an early sobriety. I try not to today. It was a journey that I had to travel. So I'm working at this job. I'm going out at lunch. I'm going out after work. Find out that some of the guys that I'm working with drink on the job. And, man, was I in heaven. I'm making some money. I got some money in my pocket. I'm not having any bills. Forget about the rent that I was paying down there. I was paying maybe 10% of that to my parents. I'm like, I had so much more money, and, like, I really thought I was living the life. As I'm doing that, my drinking continues on. Chaos is still happening. I get into a major car accident where I had to be cut out of that car. And in my mindset, the only reason why I had that problem was I hadn't eaten in a couple days. I never thought it was a liquid in the glass. You know, that car accident happened because I was drunk. But I was out with friends at a bar, and I drove somebody home. And here was a woman that I was interested in, and this is where my alcoholism had taken me, that she asked me to stay the night because she was afraid of me getting home. And somebody that I would have loved to have spent the night with on any other given point, I couldn't. See, towards the end of my drinking, what I really held on to was that if I could get home each night, it wasn't a bad night of drinking, because I was still okay, I could get home. You know, it can't be bad. A drunk couldn't get home. That's what I thought. Well, I didn't get home that night. I wrecked the car that I was in, drove it into a fire hydrant in a tree, and I was only like a block and a half away from my house. And what happened was, after they cut me out, they got me to the hospital. They never gave me a blood test. They never checked my alcohol or anything like that. But people from a clinic there called the Van Ouse Clinic, they came in and they talked to me. They talked to me about the disease of alcoholism. And for this drunk up here, that wasn't the first time I've heard about that. I heard about it throughout high school, guidance counselors, teachers, a whole lot of people. I had a lot of wonderful people in my life that were looking out after me. I just wasn't ready. Here, these people came in and they talked to me. They wanted me to come inpatient. They wanted me to try to get some help. They heard about my drinking and they knew where I was at. And the honesty of it is, I thought for a moment that maybe they were right. But I had another great thought that if I thought about it overnight, I'd be convinced of what they were saying. And they weren't convinced about that part. They weren't too happy about that. So, but that's what they did. They tried to convince me about inpatient, outpatient, this patient, that patient. I think any kind of patient that they had, they wanted me to be one of those. I just wasn't ready. See, for me, it wasn't the alcohol in that glass. It was I hadn't slept, I hadn't eaten, and that was what my problem was. They kept me for about 4 days. This was right before Thanksgiving in 1992. They let me go from there. That was the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. That night I was back at the bar. And the reason why I say that was when I got to the bar, I didn't drink for like the first hour. It came around midnight. I had a couple drinks, and I didn't get drunk. And see, to me, that proved that I wasn't an alcoholic. I said, if I was really an alcoholic, I would have been drunk that night. Well, I can tell you now that for the next 3 months, I really have no clue what happened. I went to work because I know I got my W-2s, and I know I drank. Those are the two constants that I can tell you. Anything else I really did, I don't know. I went on a tear like it was the end of times. Drinking, not going to work, not being able to function, sleeping at the job. And it was fortunate that I had a lot of friends and a lot of people that I knew at the job. They took care of me. Right, wrong, or indifferent, that's what they did for me. I got a promotion at that job. I went from working in a warehouse to working in an office. I had applied and I was going to go back to college. I started taking some college classes through this 3 month period. I turned 24 and I thought my life is starting to come together. As Bill Wilson writes in his story when he was up in Canada, that he said, I had arrived. That's exactly how I felt at that point in time. Because I thought everything had come together in my life. And well, a month, 6 weeks later, I'm on my knees crying because I have no clue what's happened. See, it was the week of Valentine's Day back in 93. And a woman I was interested in told me she wasn't interested in me. And I was going to go out that night. We're all going to see a band play that we knew. I was going to show her exactly what she was missing. That's exactly where my mindset was. I was going to go out there. I was going to put on a show and see, and you don't want to see me? That's where my mind was. I was out drinking at lunch, out drinking after work. I went home. And my mother, she told me after I got sober that that night she said she had no clue how I could be going out in that state. And she said, the exact words you told me was, what else was I supposed to do? I'm like, a young man like me on a Friday night, where else am I supposed to be if not at the bar? And she said she was so disgusted at that point. Well, I went to the bar that night. Once again, no clue what happened. My drinking was all about blackouts. Drink as much as I can, as fast as I can, and whatever happens, so be it. Well, people took my keys and got me up to about two towns away from my house. They said they thought I was sober. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. They gave me the keys. I got about three blocks from there, and I destroyed another car. And this was like a 77 Cutlass Oldsmobile, like a big old steel tank of a car that, like, you could drive it through, like, a brick wall, and it probably would still be standing. Not when I'm driving it. And I took out a fire hydrant, landed right by a cement uprise, and my first thoughts at that moment was, if I run from this car, nobody will know that I was here. They can't prove that I was driving the car. And what happened was this small little, like, Ford and two-door hatchback kind of thing came down the road. And these people stopped to see if I was okay. They were concerned about somebody they did not know anything about. And the thought that came to my head was, oh my, if I continue down that road, I could have killed them. And I stopped in my tracks at that point and said, you know what, I can't do this anymore. And for those 3 months while I was out there, those last 3 months, every night when I got home, I had asked not to wake up in the morning. I had tried suicide a few times, and it was never successful. That's why I'm standing here. But I didn't want to live anymore. I couldn't live the way I was living. And when that incident happened, I was like, I can't do this. I had a young nephew and a young niece. And I was like, I could be one of those people that could kill them. Because when I'm drinking, I don't care about anybody else. And I froze and I sat and I waited. And I waited for the cops to come. And I knew I was in a lot of trouble. And they gave me that DWI test, and I passed it with flying colors. So I was always good at tests, even in school. Give me homework assignments? No, that wasn't good. The test, yeah. Well, I passed that one with flying colors. They held me for a while. They finally released me, and I got home. I sat on my parents' basement pool where I was living. I shaked, and I shook. Because I didn't know what to do. Remember, I just thought I had arrived, and now this is happening like 6 weeks later. And I cried out for help. I cried out to the God that my parents brought me up in. And what came to my thought was I had an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper that had meetings that were all walking distance from my house. Somebody a couple years prior had given me that piece of paper. And I looked at that list, and I had looked at that list for a couple years. Every once in a while I'd open it up, look at it, and go, maybe, and then go, now, fold it back up and throw it in the corner of the room. And I went and got that page that morning. And it was a Saturday morning, and there was a Saturday night hall with open speaker meeting. I'd love to say that that was the first meeting I made. That wasn't the case. I looked at the list, and I saw Sunday night, open speaker meeting in Bergenfield, New Jersey. At that time, it used to say across from Rickles, well, the Rickles ain't there, it's a Staples, but that meeting is still there. And the reason why I didn't go to that Saturday night was, well, that woman that back in November that I said I didn't want to spend the night with, well, I had plans with her that night, and I wasn't going to change that. And that's why I didn't go that Saturday night, but that Sunday I made a commitment to be at that meeting, and I was there. And I'd love to tell you what the speaker said. I'd love to remember any of that. I don't know. What I remember most was how the people came up to me after that meeting. Because I was sitting across from the table when the lights came back on, with somebody I went to high school with, and this guy was sober for a couple years. And he asked me, he said, John, you have no clue who I am, do you? And nope, I had no clue who he was. He started telling me who he was. I was like, and in not so nice language, I was like, I wonder what happened to you. And he had gotten sober, it was like 3 years later, and no wonder why I hadn't seen him. I was out there drinking, he wasn't. And it's like, you know what, hang out here. There's some people I want to introduce you to. And what he did was he introduced me to about 10 people, say about 5 years, either way of my age at that point. And what I remember most about this crew of people was this. The faces were full of color, their eyes were open, they were smiling, they were laughing, they were telling me what was happening in their life, and they told me they were not drinking. And I don't know about anybody else, that was not characteristics of anybody I was hanging out with. And so they started talking to me, and they continued to talk to me for about an hour or so like that. And then they went, where are you going tomorrow night, John? I said, well, I got this list, and they said it says Monday night to Amherst. And they went, good, we'll be there. Some of us will be there. We can't all be there, but some of us will. And back in my mind, I went, yeah, right. Because once again, anybody that I hung out with when I was drinking, they said they were going to do something, and never happened. Well, a couple people walked me until I could get home that night. I found out a few years later the reason why they did that was they were afraid I was going to go to one of the bars that I had to pass. They told me that. I said, I didn't even remember there were bars on the road at that time. My mind was that shot. Well, I went to that meeting the next night, and you know what? About 4 or 5 of them were there, and I was shocked. And they said, and this continued to go on, day after day, week after week. And the colonies started asking me a lot of crazy questions, at least I thought they were at the time. Hey, John, you got a home group yet? John, you making any more phone calls? You getting more phone numbers? You reaching out to anybody? John, you got a commitment? John, you got a sponsor? And me and the person that I was, man, these people were caring about me, and I hated saying no, because every time I said no to them, I felt like I was getting, like, that cartoon character that kept shrinking, well, that's how I felt. So you know what? I got a home group. So the next time they asked me about a home group, I went, yeah. I said, I'm a member of that Saturday Night Harvard group. And they went, great. And they're like, and you're calling people now. I'm like, yeah, I've been talking to a bunch of people. They went, great. You got a commitment. I'm like, no. And then that Saturday night, they made me the greeter at that meeting. So now I could go back to them and say, yeah, I got that, I got a commitment. And the last one I did was get that sponsor. See, for me at that point, I felt that if I had gotten a sponsor, I would be like really a part of it. I still wasn't sure where I stood with Alcoholics Anonymous and what was going on. And so I thought I was going to play this game. There was this guy, Chris, who was chairing the beginners meeting I was going to. Chris is about 6'6", blonde hair, and me being all 5'7 or so. And we were complete opposites that way. And when I met him, the meeting was held in the back room of this church, and it was on, like, living room furniture. So he was sitting on the back of his living room couch, and looking down at me, I was like, oh, I really don't like this guy. And so when I told him, I knew he wasn't going to be around for a month or so, because he had told me that. So I went out to everybody, I'm like, you know what, the next time I see Chris, he's the exact person I need to be my sponsor. They went crazy. And week went by, 2 weeks went by, 3 weeks went by, and he wasn't around. I knew he wasn't. I was like, I'm still waiting on Chris. Has anybody seen him? They're like, no. I'm out at a diner with everybody after a Wednesday night meeting, and he comes in from being back off the road. And they went, John, there's Chris. Boom. I shrunk down like that cartoon character again because I was being called on my stuff. You know, I can stand up here tonight and tell you that that was the best thing that ever happened to me. I went up to the guy and was like, I said, Chris, man, I need a sponsor. I need to start doing something. I said, I don't know what it really is, but can you do that for me? He was like, well, I've seen you around. Do you really want to get sober? I was like, yeah. And can you call me each day? I'm like, yeah. I was like, good, let's start right from there, and we'll see where this thing goes. And he's no longer my sponsor, but he's still a big part of my support group. He has been since when I first met him. And I'm going to go out and see him and his family out in Arizona. They just bought a house out there, and it's been a true blessing having him in my life. I don't remember a lot of what we did those first couple years. My first couple years in sobriety, there's a lot of a fog. I went to meetings. I got involved in doing a lot of different things. I started working the steps with Chris. We started going through this work. But those first couple years are a fog. And that's just the truth for me. I remember when we were going through and talking about the third step and having God in my life. I remember it was a wonderful spring day. I called him up and I was like, Chris, man, this guy was so blue today. Oh, no, I saw him at a meeting that night. And I was like, dude, I was looking up at this guy and it was so blue. And the grass was so green. And he just started chuckling. See, those are not things that I was looking at when I was out there drinking. I hadn't looked and seen anything like that in so long. That was like an amazing experience for me. And I was like, we started talking more about this God and if I haven't God in my life that I can turn things over to. And I was like, did you have anything to do with any of that that you would tell me that you love so much today? And I was like, no, of course not. It's like, there's got to be something out there that can you at least believe in that for the time being? And that made sense to me and I could do that. And you know what? From that period, my belief and understanding in a higher power in God has grown, changed. I battled. I have conflicts with it. But I always have a power that I believe in. I have a God that I believe in. And that's something that continues to develop. He told me I needed to get involved and do my fourth step. I would love to tell you that I sat down right away and started writing. That wasn't the case. Because I read into this and I understood about the sixth step and then having to share it with somebody. And see, I felt like if I did this work that I was going to be a hole in that donut. And I was so afraid to share that with somebody. And when I finally said that to him, he's like, you're not going to be that. God will not leave you. And then I had this gentleman at the Friday night big book meeting that I was going to at the time. He said, John, I'm tired of hearing you that you won't write this. He said, why don't you write on what's blocking you off from God today? And that was probably the most powerful statement that I ever heard about the fourth step. It's one that I share with guys that I work with today, and it's one that I continue to use when I do this work. Because it's what's blocking me off from God today. Through that, I was able to finally do my fourth step, and then I shared my fifth step with them. And I always share when I talk about that fifth step was that my sponsor was on it at the time. Because you guys, when I read through those directions, it said, anybody I have a resentment with. It didn't say no matter how great or how small. And I remember when I shared that fifth step with them, it was like, we're going down the names. He's like, and I said, Chris, Chris McGee. He's like, what am I doing on here? I said, we're not at that point yet. We're starting up at the top, right? I said, we'll get to that. Reason why he was my age. He was 5 years sober longer than me. His life was coming together. He was engaged to a woman, going to have a family and stuff like that, and I was jealous. And I had to write on that. And I had to get free of that. It was what was blocking me off from God. That's what I had to write on. After that, I realized that I needed a sponsor that was, like, local, that I could find at meetings, that I could see, and so I found somebody that was in my area. And I told Chris this. He understood where I was coming from, because he knew the kind of person I was. And that was a great thing, because I found another wonderful gentleman that brought me through the rest of the steps at that point in time. Through this process, I got involved in service beyond the home group. I got involved in our district, within our area, which I'm still involved. I believe in service beyond the home group because it's been taught to me that that is how we carry the message to the alcoholic that doesn't know that AA is here for them. And I know I need to do that. Through that process, I got involved. I'm working with other people, involved in our area, involved in my home group, doing a lot of different things, going from one job to another, getting promotions. My life is coming together in a lot of wonderful ways. And roughly 2 years ago, I was at a place where I thought maybe I was making a little too serious of all this work. Maybe I didn't need to be going to the meetings that I was going to. Maybe I could just, like, rest on my laurels a bit. And that I didn't need Alcoholics Anonymous the way that I was doing this. Because I saw other people having a great life and not having to be as serious as I thought I would be. And I was at a meeting that night. I ran into a gentleman. He was sharing that same exact story. The difference was it was 8 years later for him, and he hadn't drank. And he was telling exactly where I was, being in the same kind of place. I was like, man, I ran after that guy after that meeting like crazy. Because something that you guys told me early on was that don't leave before the miracle happens. Well, you know what? That was a miracle happening right there. And because here was somebody sharing that same story. And I ran after him, and I got hooked up with this guy. And we started going back through the work again. And because I needed to do that. And we started at the beginning of that book and we went through that book. And I did the steps that I needed to and I did the work that I needed to. I had a wonderful experience doing that. And he's been a blessing in my life also. And I say that because I've run into a lot of people since that happened to me that's been in that same spot who wasn't sure what they needed to do. And I'm no different than anybody else. If I feel that way, maybe somebody else does. And I don't want anybody to have to die because of feeling that they shouldn't share that. That they shouldn't be able to say that, you know what, with multiple years, they felt like they didn't need to be here. Because that's where I was at. And through that experience, I've been given a lot of blessings. Alcoholics Anonymous has been there. You guys have taught me another way of living. And I say it that way because I didn't know how to live. I wasn't a functioning person. I did whatever I had to, but that to me isn't functioning. You taught me how to, in the beginning, how to have regular meals. You know, how to, like, take a shower. Take a shower each day, Jaron. What an amazing concept. For me, I wasn't doing those things. That was too much time and effort. You know, how to show up at my job and be responsible. How to be responsible with my family. And through that process, it was 6 years ago, my mother passed away. And it was sudden. We didn't know she anything was wrong with her or anything like that. And that day was out consoling two friends. A dear friend of mine and his fiance at the time, because her mother had passed that day. I brought her to a meeting. And I told everybody at that meeting, I'm like, I don't care what you're doing tonight. You go into this diner because I'm going to be bringing Steve over there because he needs to be around some people. He needs some support right now. And we had that whole diner filled. I think there was like 50-some-odd people at that diner that night. I brought her back to her dad's house, and then I brought him to that diner. When I dropped him off, he was very grateful, and I went home because I was still living with my parents. And lo and behold, I didn't know that I was going to have to be dealing with the same thing that same night. And our family still, like, shake our heads when we see each other, because it's very bizarre. But I look at that as still as a blessing because God was in here and allowed me to be able to make amends to my mom. I had no regrets. I didn't feel like I was holding on to anything. I was being of service for other people. I think that allowed me to, like, just be able to respond that night. I was like, okay, we need to get over to the hospital. But my dad was there. My sister was waiting for me. We got over there. I made the phone calls I had to. I was able to just respond and not think about things and not feel at that point. I think that's exactly what I needed because I don't know how I would have been otherwise. I say that because that was something that I thought I could never get through. I thought I would have to drink over that. And I didn't have to. And I only learned that by showing up here and by being a part of and hearing that other people had gone through the same thing. And I knew that no matter what happened in my life, I did not have to drink. And that's something that I've learned here, that no matter what goes on, I will be okay. As long as I stay close to God and stay close to this fellowship. Because the life that I've been given is amazing. And the journeys I can. And before I close, I met Karen, who asked me to come up here and speak back in Toronto at the International Convention. We had just started talking, and then we were staying in touch by email. I said I was coming up here for business, and she's like, well, I want you to come speak at our home group. And that blows me away. You know, and I say that because, you know what, I'm just an alcoholic. I'm a drunk like anybody else, and I've been given this gift. And somebody says they want me to come and be a part of it, of their home and their home group because a home group is so important to me because it's where I get rooted and where I get involved to be of service because I need to be. And somebody asked me to be a part of that. Man, that is an amazing gift. And I hope to be able to run into some of you. And I really thank you all for being here tonight. And thank you for listening to me.